Afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It is April 4th, 2013, and I would like to start with opening a work session on House Bill 2896. Sandy, can you?
Right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2896 is prohibiting licensed tanning facilities from allowing persons less than 18 years of age to use a tanning device that is owned and operated by an entity. It allows licensed tanning facility to service minors if the parent or the legal guardian provides the documentation from a physician recommending tanning for medical purposes, and the tanning facility only allow minors to use the tanning device according to the physician's recommendations. We had a public hearing on this bill on March 20th. Madam Chair, we have a dash 6 amendment before us that is changing it from a person less than 18 years of age to a person less than 17 years of age. We do have a fiscal impact on the dash 6 amendments and a revenue impact on the dash 6. It's a minimal expenditure impact and it's a no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Okay, good. All right, we are in work session.
Yes, and you want this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 6 amendment to House Bill 2897.
Senator, 2896?
Yes, that would work probably better.
Yes, 2896. Senator Cruz moves the dash 6s into House Bill 2896. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'd be very interested to hear from representatives of the tanning industry about their thoughts about this amendment.
Okay. Tanning industry. Okay.
Do we have anybody?
Yes, and also Susie Funkhauser, would you like to come up too? All right. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What do you all think about this amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, we had offered, if you recall correctly, an under 16 amendment, and would have supported that strongly. We feel this isn't exactly what
your name for the record.
I'm so sorry. Jana Jarvis, representing the American Sun Tanning Association. This isn't our first choice, but we do see this as a compromise that we can support. It's not the if you will pass this amendment, we won't be fighting your actions on this bill. So we would be supportive of this.
Okay. May I ask a follow-up, please, Madam Chair? I guess, what do you think the difference is? Why do you think 17-year-olds are more capable of making this decision than 18-year-olds, given that we, you know, for everything else that has the potential to be a carcinogen, leaving aside whether you think you can do it safely or not, we all know that UV radiation has the potential to be a carcinogen. Pretty much everything else that we can regulate, we put at 18 for things like that. I'm just curious about why you think it's safer at 17 than at 18.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I think there was some discussion, if you recall, in committee about the change in freedoms that 16-year-olds experience with the ability to drive. And we felt that it was better to have them participate in this industry in a regulated fashion than in an unregulated fashion. And that was one of the reasons that we were willing to go with an under 16. If you look at the difference between 17 and 18, I think between 16 and 17, I think there is some maturity that comes into play with that. But I think in general, the industry is concerned about the impressions that are left with under 18 and the carcinogen and the comparison to cigarettes. And I think that was one of the reasons that we were very concerned about the analogies that were made during the hearing and that with respect to that issue. At the end of the day, anything used in an abusive fashion can be dangerous to you, but I think there was some dispute about whether or not the sun, in general, is as dangerous as cigarette smoke.
But, I mean, I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing. We all know that there are safe levels of sun exposure and there aren't really safe levels of cigarette exposure. But
correct.
I guess my concern is that we know that, my understanding of the data is that 30% of Caucasian girls in, who are seniors in high school use tanning occasionally, at least occasionally, if not more regularly. So I worry that that's sort of the gateway time, and I guess that's why I'm still a little concerned. I mean, I this is certainly better than nothing, Madam Chair, but I guess I'm not super happy with this amendment.
Thank you. Susie, do you want to comment on the dash sixes?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susie Funkhauser. I'm the Director of State and Local Relations for OHSU. I would like to pass on some comments from Dr. Drucker. He wanted to be here today but could not. As you all know, UV tanning beds are classified as a known carcinogen by the FDA. This classification is reserved for the worst chemicals and products where the evidence is indisputable that it causes cancer. We oppose the Dash 6 amendment and believe that it is a significant weakening of the bill. The amendment would allow 17-year-olds to use UV tanning, as you know. We think this amendment actually takes us backwards from what we currently have. Currently, 17-year-olds are required at least a one-time parental consent in the state, and this would allow 17-year-olds to tan without that parental consent. But our biggest concern remains that we know that 17-year-olds are actually the largest demographic under 18 that are actually using UV tanning. While only 13% of high school students are using UV tanning, we know 32% of Caucasian senior girls are actually using UV tanning, and predominantly these girls are 17 years old. So on top of that, we have another statistic that says that 40% of girls between the age of 16 and 18 are using UV tanning devices. So we think the Dash 6 completely removes the age that most needs this protection. And we think that if this is good enough for 16-year-olds, we should also be protecting 17-year-olds. So from our standpoint, we oppose this amendment strongly and are disappointed to see it here today.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions? As you know, the opponents don't really like this, and the proponents don't like this. And so that's how we sometimes pass legislation where we try to come try to meet some consensus. So the Dash 6s were put forward. I want to make sure that we put on the record that the tanning device definition is any equipment used for tanning of the skin that emits electromagnetic radiation with wavelengths in the air between 200 and 400 nanometers, including but not limited to a sun lamp, UV lamp, tanning booth, facial unit, UVA wand, or tanning bed. So I know that that was a concern before. Also, the vitamin D issue, the best way to get vitamin D is to take a once-a-day pill, which is proven. This is research, evidence-based. And so that's all I wanted to put on the record. So is there any opposition to the Dash 6s?
Yeah, I object to the Dash 6s.
Okay. Clerk will call the roll then.
Senator
Sandin
Hewitt?
No.
Senator
Kneel?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Monahan? Aye. Amendment adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2896 with the Dash 6 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2896 as amended with the Dash 6s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Yes. Senator Steiner Hayward?
I'm going to vote yes to get it out of committee, and I'll probably vote yes on the floor, but I'm going to make it very clear now and on the floor that I'm really not happy with this. I think we're doing a significant disservice to the young people of the state, and I'm really worried about why we're doing this. I'm very concerned. So this is better than nothing, but it's nowhere close to what I hope we would get, nor what Dr. Drucker and others had hoped we'd get.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to vote no in committee and no on the floor, just because I think it goes too far, quite frankly. And I really think the threshold ought to be at 16. So I appreciate the efforts of everybody involved.
All right. Thank you. Any other discussion? Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was it the intention of the drafting of the dash sixes that people who were 17 would not have to get parental consent? I'd like to at least set the record straight mm-hmm. for the legislative history.
Wait, so then now we're going from them having to have parental consent to now they're actually getting less restriction than they had before this bill was passed?
Well, that's what Ms. Funkhauser has mm-hmm. suggested. I'd like to at least make sure we know what we're getting with the dash six.
So this completely preempts the existing legislation that
And this was the first time that we have heard that. Yes.
Chair Mona Sanderson, the parental consent standard for under 18 has been through the regulatory process and was never based on statute. And we are not asking for that to be changed.
Does this amendment change it? Do we have any? Susie, can you help us understand what you were saying?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that's my understanding from the department that since this is in state regulation, state statute trumps state regulation, so they'll have to revise their regulations to demonstrate, because currently anyone under 18 has to have one-time parental consent. So if this is saying 17, that's the challenge there.
So that could be done in rule?
I believe that's correct, Madam Chair.
Susie, I question that. What this does now is basically prohibit a person under 17. I mean, that's a straight prohibition, but it doesn't really change anything else.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, my understanding is current regulation is that anyone under 18 has to get one-time parental consent. So my understanding with the Dash 6 amendment adopted is that anyone under 17 will not be allowed to TAN,
right.
And then between 17 and 18, this statute doesn't speak to that, but they're believing that that's my understanding, that that's what they have said to me, so that's my understanding.
Extremely important to keep that one-time parental consent, and that was the intent of, that was our understanding, and this is the first time that you have brought this to our, which I'm disappointed in, that we didn't know this earlier.
Well, I think go ahead and finish.
Yeah, no. So I would like to have counsel maybe by the end of today. So we'll just hold this as is until we can get counsel, which many times they're watching us.
Just close your work session.
Yeah. So right now we will close the work session on House Bill 2896, and we will open a public hearing on, I'm going to change the order. I want the autism bill to be last since we have so many people here. So I'd like to open Senate Bill 506. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 506 is brought to you from at the request of Senator Betsy Close. The bill is excluding secure residential treatment homes and facilities as permitted use under the zoning requirement. It requires secure residential homes and facilities notify County Mental Health Authority of the names of residents placed in the county who are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Madam Chair, and
yes.
Senator Close is here.
Senator Close is here.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I'll go get her.
Okay, if you can go get Senator Close and then John Lindsay and is it Marcia Mendita? No. Katarina Rosenfeld? So come forward. And we would like John Lindsay. John is not here?
I just saw him.
Yeah,
where? He will be out in the hall.
So I would like him to start. And Senator Close. Senator Close, I think, is in hearing room. What a hearing room.
Well,
go ahead.
Hello.
Please introduce yourself.
I am Katerina Rosenfeld, and I have firsthand testimony on the impact of placing sexual predators and other extremely violent felons in housing among children. In 1998, I moved with my 9-year-old daughter into housing named Pickford Leonard in Corvallis that was run by a nonprofit. My 18-year-old son had suffered injury and required a serious surgery, and because of this, I had lost my business and my home. I was offered a HUD voucher and told that Pickford Leonard Complex was a wonderful place for children. 1 year later, I learned that the owners, Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services, had partnered with the Lynn Benton Housing Authority to build an IRS tax credit-funded housing development in Camas Commons, and that LBHA would now manage my housing. Soon, all of the hard-to-rent units at Pickford Leonard were filled with felons with long and dangerous criminal histories. From 1999 through 2003, I watched a sweet family neighborhood morph into what I consider a hellhole, as each of the sexual predators and violent offenders and methamphetamine dealers repeated the crimes they had done for many years in the upstairs of my house and in the houses surrounding mine with my 9-year-old daughter. Most of these felons suffered serious mental illness and were placed in conjunction with Benton County Mental Health or Benton County Probation and Parole. The effect of housing repeat offenders around children was devastating, and neither the Housing Authority nor the owners heard as the mothers from Pickford Leonard begged for relief from the horror of having our children live in deep, continual fear of rape or death. I learned that a sexual predator is obsessed with finding his next victim and targets the children around him. James Hickman lived in the house next to mine in a HUD-funded unit, and he had been in prison before he moved there for attempting to sodomize a small child. Under the Federal Protection of Children statutes, which are U.S. Code 42, Chapter 135, Subchapter 5, Section 13661 through 13663, he was not to be housed using federal dollars, and yet he was, because there is no enforcement of those statutes locally. I spoke with the Office of Inspector General of HUD many times, and they do not have the manpower or funds to monitor housing authorities across America. The public is not aware of the federal laws or that these dangerous placements are being made illegally. We need state statutes to match the federal statutes, and more importantly, the intent of the federal statutes, which is to protect children. Some of the other felons that were placed among the children, we had Barry Brown that had over 60 arraignments in Benton County prior to his placement in the upstairs of my house. It ended up that this use of family housing as a halfway house was the precursor for the group home misuse of these federal funds. The kind of behaviors that we experienced with Mr. Brown, he stalked my 10-year-old, broke into our unit repeatedly, tapped all of the mother's phones, slashed the children's swimming pools, slashed tires, put sugar in the tanks of our cars, destroying the engines. He also rewired our house, so I and another mother were paying for his electricity. He did something to us every day. Someone that has 66 arraignments in a county and can't be placed anywhere and is placed in a home like this, the pattern that they have is ongoing, and they're not going to change their behavior, I experienced. Walter Morgan intentionally harassed my child the entire time he lived in my house and sold drugs out of his unit. He had a violent criminal history, including threatening a woman with a knife. He poisoned our cat the day that he moved out. He was allowed to stay there a month after he tried to bash in my window. James Reed paid each of the teenage boys in the neighborhood with methamphetamine to steal bikes on Oregon State University campus. He had a 14-year history of felonies, including creating methamphetamine and selling it. My daughter and I truly and deeply suffered while living at Pickford Leonard. She woke up with little crescent cuts in her forearms where she dug her nails into her arms while she slept. She had blood on her pillow in the morning where she chewed up the inside of her mouth while she slept. Often she could not sleep at all because she said she was afraid that Barry Brown or James Hickman or James Reed or Walter Morgan would come into our home and kill us. Actually, she was afraid he would kill me, and I was afraid he would kill her, so neither of us slept. We found our door unlocked often in the mornings. My daughter fell asleep in school often, and she went from being a straight A student to having no interest in school. She was a skilled violinist and a talented ballerina, and she gave these up. Each of the children at Pickford Leonard suffered, and few have had success as young adults. Cruz Cassidy was a teen who told me how James Reed offered the boys meth for working for him to steal bikes. Cruz went to prison.
Excuse me, Katarina. I didn't realize your testimony would take so long, and I think we need to give preference to Senator Close to at least give her testimony first, and then you can continue.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Cummings. Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the Health Care and Human Services Committee. This will be very short. Katarina has lived this. I have not. I am Senator Betsy Close. I'm sponsoring this bill on behalf of Commissioner John Lindsay of Linn County. Colleagues, we have over the years been developing a system of community care in our 36 counties. Senate Bill 506 is needed to fulfill the important obligation in our counties to notify our local law enforcement of the licensing and location of secure residential treatment homes in the county area. Some counties do that, I have found. Some do not. We also desire that our county mental health authority has a list of residents who are in the county but under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The zoning portion of the bill is needed to make these modifications possible, as I understand it. Thank you for your consideration of Senate Bill 506.
Thank you, Senator Close. Any questions for Senator Close? We can let her go. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and go ahead, Katarina.
I was just talking about Cruz Cassidy, the young man who was a teen in the neighborhood, and his role models as a fatherless boy in that neighborhood were some of the most dangerous felons in Oregon. He is now in prison and has been there for 9 years for killing someone. Both of James Reed's sons, he was the meth dealer upstairs who also had a long, violent criminal history. He came out of the penitentiary the day he was moved upstairs in my house by Benton County. Both of James Reed's sons were found dead in the Willamette River in 2008. The part of all of this is that is so hard to convey to anyone who is not there is how the overwhelming fear that my daughter and I felt never went away. We experienced it every moment of every day and night while we lived at Pickford Leonard and carry a hypervigilance with us for life from the nightmare we were forced to endure living amongst felons with long and dangerous histories of violent and drug-related crime. As an afterthought to my written testimony, I have written papers for each of you. When I learned that one of the most dangerous sexual predators in Oregon, Alfred Nemnich, was placed in a group home in close proximity to over 100 families with children, I visited the finance office for Benton County and learned that approximately $1 million was funneled through the state to Benton County and to that group home in 1 year's time, and this included commingled federal funds being used in violation of federal statutes. So I really implore you to ensure that the bill before you that will keep this from happening to other families is passed.
Thank you. Mr. Lindsay.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I submitted a packet for your committee earlier, a couple days ago, for you to do it, and I wanted to keep this real short because I understand that you're under time. I just wanted to thank you for having the hearing on SB 502 today. My name is John Lindsay. I'm a county commissioner with Linn County. I've served in that capacity since 1998. The bill before you is quite simple. The Oregon legislature put together a PSRB work group appointed on April 21st, 2008. The group issued its final report on February 6, 2009. I have attached a couple of the excerpts that come from that report. That would be under tab number one. The recommendations in the final report still have not been acted on. SB 506 addresses only two of those recommendations. The two it covers have been a priority of law enforcement for several years. It has also been a priority of the Linn County Board of Commissioners for several years. Second, it involves communities with the placement of violent known felons in their neighborhoods. Failure to do so has met with tragic consequences over the year. As you read what the members of the work group accomplished, that it maintained widespread report but still has yet to have any of the implementation measures put into place. For your convenience, I gave you an explanation sheet of what is in this folder. Under tab 1, is the edits that I used to have the two subjects covered from the PSRB group. Tab 2 is the Sheriff's Association letter from 2007 endorsing having that group come together. That letter is voted on every year, and it's in full force right now. Tab 3 is the correspondence between a previous Senate attempt in the last session to write this bill. As a side note, I would say that the letter that I corresponded with Senator Grassley on the Oversight Committee at the U.S. Senate on these federal dollars, I pointed out that the HIPAA discussion inside there does not apply. The U.S. Attorney General now has placed that HIPAA explanation on his website. Tab 4 is my original notification and of the housing funds that were being used in this process, and Congressman DeFazio's position backing my position also on this. The criminal justice flowchart that we're having the problem with, if you follow down, I've made a little pen note in there for you. There is no parole and probation on any of this stuff. The criminal that was mentioned earlier, when I contacted the Clackamas County DA's office on this individual, I go, do you know where he's at? And he goes, oh, he's locked up for life. And I go, no, he's not. He's in a group home. The assistant DA, she had called me back, and that started my kind of relationship with the Clackamas County DA's office. Under that next tab, you'll notice that there is a position paper on the Clackamas County DA and the list of 850 proposed releases that are being talked about right now from Oregon prisons into that system. We are commingling health with judicial. And under federal statutes, we cannot do that. And also under SSDI statutes that are also included in here, you are not supposed to do that. And I would like to thank the committee for hearing this bill and giving consideration to it. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Okay. Questions for this panel? All right. Bob Jundeff, Kevin McChesney, and Maria Mendita de Juarez. So you, pardon? Would you like to testify? No, I want you to testify now, okay? Maria, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Dear Honorable Senate Committee, I am Maria Mendiola de Juarez. I am 52 years of age. I live on Ramona Lane. My husband and I moved to Corvallis in 1991 to go to college. I have been living in Oregon for the past 25 years. I am a citizen of the United States. Okay. The group home that houses three registered sex offenders next door to my house is destroying our lives. I am scared all the time. My doctor told me I should take medication for my high blood pressure. Caged by this stress that is affecting everyone in my family. We didn't have this problem before these people moved next door to my house. We live in North Corvallis in a rural setting, with houses with 2 acres lots. And when my neighbors moved in, I went there with my five-year-old to welcome them, because this is what happened to me moving back. When we moved there to this area. People came to my home and welcomed me. And that's what I did. Little did I knew who these people were. And since then, our life have really changed. I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional, but this is what is happening right now. I have 3 children, and I homeschool one of them, which is physically disabled. For this reason, we spend most of our time at home. Now with 6 offenders next door, he and I are suffering emotionally and physically, logically. When the 6 offenders first moved in. Nobody told us who they were. I went next door with my five-year-old son to welcome them. They quickly turned me away without any explanation, saying only that they were a group home for men. I was horrified when the sheriff came to my home a couple weeks later after they moved to tell us how dangerous the men next door were. When my 18-year-old son was four, a rapist that broke into my apartment attacked me. My son was present when I was attacked. Now that there are extremely dangerous sex offenders next door, we live under fear.
You're doing fine.
I'm having flashbacks. I really sleep with scissors under my pillow. I cannot function anymore. Even though it has been 2 years since the sex offenders moved in, we still cannot sleep. My husband works overnight. And when my children play in my backyard, they are in plain view of these sex offenders. Some of my neighbors have lost hope, and others are trying to move away, except that they cannot sell their homes. We are seeking professional psychological help right now. There's a question for you. How can it be legal to have three registered sex offenders in this family neighborhood? Please help us. My next door neighbor, has six children, nine and under of age, and she's a daughter of a retired police officer. She's worried, and everybody that I know in that community have children especially. We've been doing meetings to see what can we do at but it's been hard to really advance since there is not a state laws that can really help us at this point. And for that reason, I'm asking you to help us, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your story. I think it's important for us to hear your experiences, as well as for the agency that deals with this, to hear your stories. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here representing, my name's Kevin McChesney, and I'm here representing the Oregon Residential Providers Association, otherwise known as ORPA, whose membership includes most of the mental health residential providers in the state of Oregon. ORPA opposes this bill for a number of reasons. Firstly, because the population served in residential care, at least the mental health residential care system, are first and foremost individuals with a disability. The level of care they're placed in is determined by the level of services they need. And those that require secure residential services are most in need of a structure and controlled environment, and are not necessarily a danger to the general public, as this bill implies, even those under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Secure residential programs notify local law enforcement of their presence in communities, but do not necessarily disclose the names of specific individuals being served there unless there's a clear public safety reason for doing so. Local law enforcement is currently notified if someone under the jurisdiction of the PSRB is placed in a secure residential facility. Lastly, this bill also opens the door for planning offices to oppose the placement of residential facilities that would otherwise be allowed. It also does not differentiate between types of secure facilities. For instance, as currently worded, an Alzheimer's facility that has locked doors to prevent people from wandering out of the facility would be treated the same way as would any other secure facility. So it's for these reasons that we oppose the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Chair Monza Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. As you know, we advocate for people who receive services in the state hospital and from the community mental health agencies around the state. Senate Bill 506, we think, is a misguided effort for a variety of reasons. The first has to do with its target, which is people under the Psychiatric Security Review Board and the system that serves them. The people that I represent in the hospital and their families believe that the Psychiatric Security Review Board is actually overly conservative in its decisions as to when to release people to the community and the level of supervision that it requires of people. However, one may view that particular issue. One thing is clear is that the PSRB has been very successful in assuring that people who have used the insanity defense, been sent to the hospital, and been transitioned back into society, which must happen eventually, that they have not reoffended. And in fact, their recidivism rate, that is the rate with which they reoffend, is 10 times, actually more than that, 15 times lower than people in the correction system. They have a very good track record in terms of recidivism. So how does that happen? It happens because the people who are under the board get ongoing clinical supervision and risk assessment. That happens while they're in the hospital and while they're in the community. And so in terms of the freedom that they may enjoy, people have to earn that in a very slow and deliberate way over time in order to assure that the community is kept safe and they're kept safe. We think this is a model that actually works very well for people who are concerned about their community safety. We also have concerns about whether this bill would be consistent with the Federal Fair Housing Act that places some controls in terms of of restricting where people with disabilities can live in communities. And for both a policy reason, that legal reason, we think that Senate Bill 506 is not the right way to go. Thank you.
Is there a recourse for the people that testified before you, a complaint process? Is there any way that they can relay the situations that they were in?
Chairman Anderson, as you know, this is an issue I've been involved with for many years, and we've had many meetings about this and some legislation come out of it to make sure that residential facilities have complaint processes. Community mental health has complaint processes, as does the state. And so when there are incidents about people acting inappropriately, parking is a big issue that comes up with group homes, that there is a way to bring those to the attention of the facility and their operators in order to seek resolution. One of the things it doesn't do, quite frankly, is it doesn't address, first of all, the fear that people have of individuals with mental illness. Second, some of the confusion that I've seen in some communities about group homes in general. I attended a community meeting in Linn County on these issues, and I found that a number of the complaints were about facilities that weren't actually licensed for mental health services and did not contain people with PSRB, they were run by other programs, and so group homes in general can be conflated in the public mind. But those fears are real. I understand those fears are real, and there are things that I think there's been efforts to try to do outreach to communities, education for communities, and involvement of all of the players in the community, including law enforcement and others. But there are some sidebars on that, and one has to do with confidentiality issues around treatment, and one has to do with housing discrimination.
Thank you. Other comments? All right, that's all that was signed up to testify. Thank you so much for coming and sharing this. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 506 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 724. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 724 is at the request of Senator Bates. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish a payment methodology to reimburse coordinated care organizations' costs in providing non-traditional health services for which there are no established billing codes. This declares an emergency as an effective on passage.
Senator Bates, I don't think was aware that this one was up today also. Okay, but I know that Janet Meyer, Debbie Farr are here to speak to it.
Them come up too at the same time.
Okay, sure.
You first, Senator.
I wasn't planning to speak. I was waiting for another bill, but that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record. Senator Alan Bates, State Senator from Southern Oregon. Committee members, thank you for hearing this bill. In our office, we call this the air conditioning bill, and this bill is part of what I call my punch list for CCOs, allowing them to do some things that we think they can do, but we want to be absolutely certain they can do, and that's developing a fund or within themselves funds that will allow them to do things like the air conditioner for the lady with congestive heart failure and things of that nature. I'm going to let the two people tomorrow present the bill a lot closer than I was, because I wasn't sure that we were going to be presenting this one today myself, frankly. Okay. But it is ready for prime time and ready to roll, and so I'm going to turn it over to both these lovely ladies.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Chair Monis Anderson, thank you very much for inviting us today. My name is Janet Meyer. I am the Chief Executive Officer of HealthShare of Oregon. We are the largest CCO in the state, serving Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, serving about 165,000 members in that region. We support Senate Bill 724 for three reasons. This is the original intent of CCOs, to offer flexible benefits and to allow us to use the global budget in ways that we know makes better sense for this population. Flexible benefits should not be considered administrative costs, and public policy really needs to support the delivery system innovation that we know we need to bend the cost curve. I want to tell you a little story about a very small example of a flexible benefit that one of our community health workers recently provided. She'd been assigned to care for a client, an enrollee, who has multiple chronic conditions, including serious mental health conditions. This enrollee is homeless and sees providers at one of our federally qualified health centers. The community health worker tried to connect with this enrollee several times in the doctor's office, in the clinic waiting room, and the enrollee was very suspicious and hesitant to engage with our community health worker. One evening at the end of her day, she walked over to the car where this enrollee lives and knocked on the window and gave the guy a couple of blankets and said, "I know you don't really want to talk to me, but this is so you won't be cold tonight." The next time that enrollee went to the doctor, the enrollee asked to talk to that health worker. They sat down and created a relationship. Now, two blankets is it's not an air conditioner, I know that. But it was a way to connect to this enrollee that made them trust and was able to take that next step. Pleased to say this enrollee is in supportive housing now. Still has lots of problems. We haven't solved all the problems, but we're making progress, and we need that flexibility, whether it's doing home assessments for kids with asthma, and sometimes what the right thing to do is to get a good vacuum cleaner in that house. Keep that kid in school. Keep that kid out of the ED. Now, we need to come up with criteria for how we spend this money. We need to be good stewards, but we need that flexibility, and we really encourage the committee to consider this bill and to help us be successful. This is the kind of public policy that really encourages innovation, so we're very excited, and we believe you can move us along on this journey by voting for this bill, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Farr, and I'm here on behalf of Trillium Community Health Plan. We're the coordinated care organization in Lane County serving approximately 55,000 Oregon Health Plan members. And Trillium has taken a very unique approach in that we are actually investing $1.33 per member per month, or approximately $900,000 this year in prevention efforts. We focused on some strategies through the work of our Community Advisory Council and our Clinical Advisory Panel that have already been adopted by the Trillium Board. The very first focus area is tobacco use, and we decided to look at some low-hanging fruit. In chart reviews, we noticed that about 32% of our Oregon Health Plan pregnant women were still using tobacco during their pregnancy. So we actually have an incentive program that we're rolling out as of July 1st. We also have evidence-based curriculum that will be offered to 15 local elementary schools that have 70% or greater children who are enrolled in the free or reduced lunch program. That will cost Trillium about $180,000, and that will come out of our administrative budget. So while we believe in prevention, we want wellness and good health for our members, we appreciate clarity around how we are going to budget for that expense, and we just appreciate your focus on furthering healthcare reform in Oregon, and we strongly support Senate Bill 724.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
I had the opportunity to talk with Ms. Meyer this morning, and I'll just make the comment to everybody that I made to her. I think it was in front of this committee 2 years ago, maybe, that my colleague, Dr. Evan Salino, told the story of his patient who, for want of a $57 shower chair, ended up with $2 million in hospital bills. So you can call this the air conditioner bill, or you can call it the shower chair bill, but I'll take 57 over 2 million. Any day of the week, and the CCOs need to be able to have that flexibility to provide these kinds of core pieces of equipment that aren't traditionally considered, or replace it on a time schedule that works for the patient. I mean, a shower chair is standard equipment, but when you're told you can only replace it every 2 years, but it breaks after 18 months and leads to $2 million in hospital bills, trade-off seems pretty clear to me. So they need to have the flexibility and need to be supported in providing a range of services that aren't traditionally, and supplies that aren't traditionally considered medical care. It's great to hear what you guys are doing with Trillium. Excited what you're doing with HealthShare. It's very cool.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Help me understand what we're doing here. Because we have a global budget per patient. Are we saying that despite the fact that you have a global budget, your OHA is saying you have to use CPT codes in order to do any billing, and work for things that you don't have a CPT code for, you can kind of come up with your own billing system so that would this also apply to somebody in private practice if they went and carried a blanket out to somebody and it was a health share patient? Could they get reimbursed for this, or what are we talking about here exactly?
We're actually trying to do a couple things here. One, we're trying to codify that spending money this way is the right thing to do for all the reasons you've just heard. The barrier to it is CPT and ICD-9 codes. You have to have a diagnosis and a code to go with it to have an expenditure. And just taking it out of administrative overhead doesn't work. We need a way of tracking it. We need a way of following it, make sure it's effective, but at the same time, giving them the leeway to do this. It's potentially possible for them to do it, I believe, with what they have now, but I think it'd have to come primarily out of administrative overhead. Correct me if I'm wrong. We're trying to codify a way of doing this in a logical way so it becomes part of the treatment for the patient. It opens up more revenue for them within their global budget to do it, and makes it a lot easier to do. CCOs are 9 months old at best. They're coming to us piece by piece of things they need. This is just one of those pieces. There are other bigger pieces, frankly, that we haven't got to. Mental health dollars are not flowing through CCOs completely yet and things of that nature. But this is one of those steps we need to do. We may make it clear that they are capable and able to spend this money in a way that's still accountable.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, kind of along the same line. We aren't talking about any more money than already exists.
Correct. Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm trying to understand. It's a capitated system. You get so much money for your people, and you are charged with delivering the services. I don't understand why it can't be done now. I mean, why does it have to come? I mean, it's got to come out of somewhere if you're going to do these things.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think there's a couple ideas going on in this bill. One is that should this be an administrative cost or should it be considered part of the medical benefits for this population? And this bill is an attempt to drive that point home that this is part of health care reform. This isn't paying claims and processing data files. This is not the same work. We have to do that work, and we have to do it in the smallest, cheapest way possible because we need all the money that we have to deliver direct care to these clients. Paying a claim and answering the phone is not necessarily direct care. Whether you're funding a stop smoking program for pregnant moms or you're giving the blanket to the homeless person, that is a direct care, and the CCOs believe that really should be reflected in the medical expense portion. In order to do that, we just need a few more codes and some opportunities to do it properly.
Are we talking the administrative cost and the medical cost is all coming out of the same pot of money, correct?
Yes, but... Okay. Yes, but, and I may be wrong, but my understanding is we are being watched by our partners in Washington, D.C. and other places saying how much is going into administration, how much is going into health, actual health delivery. I don't want to see a ballooning up of administrative costs that's not real and have to answer to people saying you're spending too much money in CCO's administration, not enough in health care. We want to separate these two clearly for no other reason than accounting so that we can account to our partners what exactly is going on.
Okay, let me have one more shot here, if you don't mind. I'm just a simple country boy. These things are confusing. Okay, so what you're saying is that for some of these services currently, you have to account for them as administrative because there's no other way to account for them. So all we're doing is giving you more categories in a closed system.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's
closed
correct.
System. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes.
That's a good way to describe it.
Senator Shields? See, it takes me a while to get there. But.
Madam Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, I probably didn't explain it very well, but that's basically what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Okay, I thought that's what this was. I just wanted to have it really clear on the record that we're not throwing more money at anything. We're just adding more categories so that the accounting can be done in a more accurate way.
And Madam Chair, this to go to Senator Shields' position. I think it's quite possible within a CCO, even though you're capitated with your patients, that you might find yourself in a position with an individual patient. You talk to your CCO and say, we need to do something about housing for this patient. We need to do something about, air conditioner or heat or something else that's outside the normal realm of healthcare, for which there'd be a way of attaching funds to and get that for the individual patient. And that's really what we're talking about here, too.
Thank you. All right.
Yes, Senator Shields.
So is there, and this could be for Janet or Debbie, I assume a lot of this also has to do with medical loss ratio for the CCOs that might go into the exchange at some point. You want to make sure that your administrative costs aren't so high that you have to return money to your patients. Is there a medical loss ratio limit for Medicaid?
Senator Montes Anderson, Senator Shields, no, there's not a limit. You could spend 100% of your money on medical expenses in Medicaid. I think we could safely keep the conversation about the exchange and this bill pretty separate. This is a bill really focused on that population that we're trying to serve in creative ways.
This is Medicaid.
So, but my point is, does Medicaid have a restriction on how much you can spend on administrative costs? Yeah.
No.
I don't know.
All right. Thank you, panel. Jeff Hetherington and Ruth Bauman.
Something?
I'm not smoking.
I wonder if it's PowerPoint. It's not electrical.
It's not electrical. It's probably exhaust. Vaguely.
Yeah.
Okay. Not strong, but vaguely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm president of Family Care Incorporated. We have about 50,000 Medicaid lives in the Portland Tri-County area. The I want to start actually by talking about the question that was being asked. When our rates are developed by the Oregon Health Authority, they look at one thing and one thing only, and that is what the cost of medical care is. They develop that budget, which is the global budget, and they give that to us, and then they add 8% for administration. Now, those are the only two things that are in the buckets.
Okay.
If we save money on the medical side to a large extent, the tradition has been, well, oh, we are saving money, so therefore we can pare back on the medical budget. And in fact, in 2006, we saw a 10% decrease in our premiums in 1 year because of what they considered to be high excess profits in that area. If we spend more than 8% on administration, they also consider that to be high. And if we're dipping into the medical expenses, they take the same point of view. Now here is how it works in terms of some of the examples. The whole navigation area that we are required to put in terms of the CCO application, those navigators in our system, we've actually had them since 2007. Those navigators cost us about $1 million a year, and what they do is they go out and help the patients make the appropriate decisions for their care. In a lot of cases, they get them to the offices. They help them direct, stay out of the emergency rooms. They make sure if they've got an appointment that they have transportation there. None of that is encounterable on the health side. In other cases, and I believe you brought this up, Madam Chair, they provide housing. We had a woman living in a tent on the Columbia River who was pregnant with twins. Never have figured out why she couldn't get housing, but she couldn't. We actually put her up for 6 months so she could deliver two healthy boys, and that saved us $2 million. But we couldn't encounter that cost, and we could have encountered the $2 million. So it's all a matter of math and how the OHA figures the math. If you have three buckets and we can count that third bucket, then we can have OHA consider the true cost of all of the requirements that the CCOs have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Ruth Rogers Bauman. I'm the chair of the Willamette Valley Community Health, the CCO here in Marion Polk Counties. I also want to speak in support of Senate Bill 724. I will make one last tie into how the expenses need to be accounted for in two ways. One, it's important for us to be able to measure the return on investment when we spend money in these areas. So the only way that we can measure that is if we have a budget for it, and we have ways to track it. The current systems of tracking don't provide us a method for doing that. I'll make one last tie to the medical loss ratio issue that Senator Shields brought up. Under the minimum loss ratio requirements under the Accountable Care Act, there is a prescription for how you count for things, and things that deal with quality of care, health information, are all considered part of the health budget. Having established that precedent for those kinds of items being included in a medical budget, we think it makes perfect sense that these items are also part of trying to support health and patient engagement, good adherence to medical protocols, and getting patients healthier. So we don't think this is anything that's not been thought of before or is out of the ordinary. We simply need the latitude and the regulations that support that.
And just to be clear, what we're telling OHA is to come up with what those standards would be, not to pass them with this bill.
Yeah, and it's a nudge also to CMS, who needs a real nudge in this area.
This testimony was helpful. I'm fine.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, there is amendment coming on this, but we will be scheduling it sometime in the future once we have the amendment and the paperwork that goes along with that. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 724 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 365. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 365 establishes the requirements for coverage of the autism spectrum disorders by health benefit plans. Public Employees Benefit Board, or PEB, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, OEB, requires the Health Licensing Agency to establish licensing procedures for providers of applied behavioral analysis, requires individuals seeking reimbursement for applied behavioral analysis from the health benefit plan, PEB, or OEB, to be licensed by the licensing agency. It grandfathers applied behavioral analysis practitioners until January 1, 2016.
Great. And Senator Bates, let's have you. And did you say you wanted Lori Freeman here?
Yeah, I want Lori to come up.
She's
probably watching.
Okay.
I can start with that.
All right. While we're waiting, let me just temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. And I just want to put on the record here that on House Bill 2896, I mean, we need to ask legislative counsel if indeed the recommendation, I mean, we need to have a parental consent. And so we will need to check with legislative counsel. And so we will just carry over Senate Bill or House Bill 2896. 96.
Oh, right there's here.
Okay, Legislative Council. Please come forward.
Madam Chair, point of clarification: is it possible to even
I will
reopen
open
the
a work
session?
Yeah, pardon.
Is it possible to even reopen the work session?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I will.
Yes, she has a quorum.
I will open a work session on House Bill 2896. And Lori, what was brought to our attention on House Bill 2896 is that the Dash 6s actually removed the parental notification. And so we need to have clarification. Is the Dash 6s, would the tanning facility still need, would that, has that gotten rid of the parental notification?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Legislative Council. I wasn't involved in the drafting of this bill. The person is ill who did, so I went back and was sort of looking into it. It does say, whereas currently there's no prohibition in statute on minors using tanning beds, this creates a prohibition and says that if you're under 17, you cannot use a tanning bed. Therefore, by giving the OHA the authority to regulate for 17 and under, it almost by implication takes away their authority to regulate for 17 and over. So I was looking at their statutes, their general public health statutes, to see if there is any general regulatory authority they would have in there. And I didn't find anything particularly. I mean, they do have pretty broad authority, but it has to be tied back into some statute. So I think you could argue either way that either this takes away their authority for over 17 or they still have that authority within their general regulatory powers.
Okay, so that has given us clarification. We will not be moving that bill today because we will definitely want it clarified that that parental notification would be required. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Madam Chair, can we therefore take the I would recommend that we take the motion to about amend the Dash
well,
6 amendment?
Well, Senator Cruz, let's wait. Let's just wait till we can remove that when we get the new ones.
There is a motion on the table to adopt the bill.
Oh, right. We take that motion off the table.
And then I would recommend that motion be taken off the table, and then you can always...
Cruz is back. So
where are we?
I would just as soon wait, and we can take it off the table when we get the new amendment.
I don't... Can we...
We've done that before where we have removed an amendment. We have adopted the amendment.
It's the motion for the bill, Madam Chair.
It's the motion for the bill.
Not the amendment. It's the motion for the bill that just...
We're in the middle of it.
Right. You're right in
the... We have not moved it.
Right. I was just making the suggestion that you might take that motion off the table, not the amendment, because you can replace that.
Madam Chair, are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
Madam Chair, I rescind the motion to move House Bill 2896. To the floor.
No. Let's go in recess, please. We're in recess. 2896.
Okay, Madam Chair, I wish to rescind the do pass as amended motion on House Bill 2896.
All right. Senator Cruz moves to rescind the motion of a do pass with House Bill 2896. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So I will close the work session on House Bill 2896 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. Take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and committee members. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from Southern Oregon. Before you have Senate Bill 365-3, I'm going to try to keep my comments short because I have a large number of people who want to speak to you about this bill, some of whom have come a great distance to talk to you about the bill itself. First off, I'd like to explain why we have this bill in front of us. As you may be well aware, we have a growing number of children who have autism in our state. We're one of the highest states in the union as far as per capita incidence of autism. It is a growing issue for us. We have struggled for many years trying to find the best way of helping these children. They are a broad spectrum, from those who have a minor amount of autistic behavior to very broad autistic behavior. We have found one method treatment for these people called applied behavior analysis. This is no longer considered experimental. It is now considered regular and routine way of successfully helping these individuals become more functional. And as we go through this bill, because of its long history and the controversy surrounding it and the difficulty that has occurred between insurers and proponents of this bill, I will ask you to keep the same thing in mind that I kept in mind as I went through it over the last year and a half with multiple work groups, some of which stopped meeting with each other, and I became sort of a envoy between the two groups. And that is to keep the children in mind first. We have children out there right now who need behavior analysis as a treatment. Maybe I need it, but they certainly do. And it's something we have to keep in mind that while this bill is controversial and difficult and has issues around it that are extremely difficult, that our focus is on helping these children. And both sides agree to that, both the insurers and the proponents. So let me walk you through the bill very quickly at a high level. You'll hear more about it as you look at it and as you hear from both sides of the equation on this. And this is the Dash 3 amendments we're looking at. These came out about 4 or 5 hours ago. I expect there will be some technical changes to them and one potentially large change to them, and I'll mention that to you as we go through. The work group sat down for multiple times over the last year and a half, and first we tried to agree on broad principles. And I'm going to walk you through those principles. The first one was that making the diagnosis of autism is not an easy diagnosis. It has many different forms. It's a broad spectrum. And the diagnosis can only be made by those who are specially trained in making that diagnosis. Average primary care physician, as myself, is not qualified to make that diagnosis. So the bill calls out for specific people who can make that diagnosis. The next issue around that, however, was this is a limited number of people. We did not want to produce a bottleneck where children couldn't get through the bottleneck and get a diagnosis in a reasonable length of time, because time is of an essence throughout this bill. The longer these children go without being treated, not being diagnosed, the more difficult it is for them to reach their full potential. So the bill calls out for specific people who can make the diagnosis and gives a 60-day time loop for response from an insurer once that diagnosis is made to confirm the diagnosis. The next problem was who is qualified to treat these individuals. The bill calls out for three different levels of qualified people. One, who is going to be a general supervisor who are specially trained in this. A second one, at a slightly lower level, who will also be doing some on-hands work with the patients. And then the behavior analysis interventionist who actually will be probably doing most of the work. The reason we're doing it this way is for twofold reasons. One, the number of people available who are actually trained to the higher levels is very limited, and they're expensive. This can be done under proper supervision by an interventionist in a way that is much more cost-effective and has the same quality and outcome as the others would be having for most of these children. The second issue we had to deal with was controls of cost and quality. The program is set up that after the diagnosis is made, there has to be a prior authorization procedure with your insurer to look at the actual plan laid out for that individual child. Now, again, this has a time limit on it of 30 days for it to be authorized. If that's not authorized, it moves forward. It gives a chance for the insurer and the individuals to discuss the case, decide what the best approach for that individual child is, and to move forward with it, again, within 30 days. After the age of 9, there's another prior authorization that has to occur. It generally is accepted that for the most cases, prior to the age of 9 is the most important time and the most effect that can be had. After age 9, there's still cases, however, where the child continues to improve with ABA. In those cases, prior authorization would also be required. All along the spectrum of treatment, monitoring will take place. Probably about every 6 months, there'll be a check-in with the family, the child, the behaviorist, and the insurer to make sure that the child continues to make progress, that the plan is working, and we're doing the right thing. There is also a calls out in the bill overlaps with other agencies, school districts, Oregon Health Authority, other places that might be doing similar things. This is to be an adjunctant to those things. It is not to be replacing them. We don't want school districts saying, we've got this child covered with ABA through an insurer. We're not going to offer any more services here at the school that we've been offering already. The bill specifically speaks out to that and says this is not going to happen. So let me move on to the last two issues here real quickly that I'm sure you're going to hear about either today or if you choose, which I hope you will, to give us a work session in about a week or so and move it on down to Ways and Means. The first discussion is going to be about something called independent review organizations. I know Senator Shields probably is well aware of those because he knows the insurance protocols. When there's a difference of opinion between an insured person and an insurance company, they usually go through a review that's internal. And that review can say yes or no about what the discussion is as far as whether you agree with the patient or don't agree with the patient. If that fails, however, or if the insured person feels they've not been treated fairly, you go to an independent review organization and get a decision from them. We have at the present time a lot of that already done in this state and in other states, but primarily we're talking about this state, where independent review organizations have ordered applied behavioral analysis to be done. It's kind of a hodgepodge. It's different for each child. There's no uniformity to it. Every different opinion is just that, a different opinion. What this bill presently says is that whatever happened before is gone, that we're going to wipe the slate clean and move forward on the, and IP, independent review organization will now rely on this bill to make their decisions. It's clear, it's straightforward. Are you following the law or you're not following the law and making your decision? And that's what we're aiming for here. The part that's difficult in that is not in the bill, and this is not your fault, okay, and this is something we're going to have to address, is there's many children out there right now getting treatment with ABA under independent review organization decisions. We don't want that interrupted by this bill. We want those children to continue to receive those services. So that's one issue you're going to hear about and one we're going to have to grapple with very quickly here the next week. I believe we can get there. The other issue is the cost of the program. We will have to get this taken down, LFO, and get as true a cost on it as we possibly can. We've had estimates from everything from $1 per member per month on a policy to $20 per month per policy. That's a lot of money at $20. I don't know where that number really is. I want that looked at very carefully, and then we can take a look at it and decide what we need to do in ways and means, because that truly is a ways and means decision at that point. It affects PEB. Affects OEB, it affects the CCOs, and of course it affects the commercial market. All that said, we have laid out a lot of work here that's never been done before in this state. The bill has, I believe, a process that allows this to go forward. The proponents of it, I believe, are tired of going through courts to win their battles, which they do win most of them. It's time-consuming, it takes years, and during those years, those children don't get treated. And many other families just haven't got the resources to do that. On the other side, the insurers realize there's a need for this. They've stepped up and worked with us on it very hard. Their concerns are that, one, the child gets the proper treatment, that the program works for the child, and that costs aren't so high that they can't be borne by the insurers and the people who are paying those premiums. I believe we've threaded the needle for most of this. I think we're at 95% there. I think both sides will support this going to Ways and Means. There will be a decision point, however, in Ways and Means over cost. And we won't have an answer for that until we get that fiscal. So I'd end there, Madam Chair. I've probably taken more time than I should have already because we have a lot of people to talk to you about this on both sides, and I want to give them an opportunity to speak to you.
Senator Cruz.
Is there any concerns at this point over the makeup of the board?
We believe the makeup of the board is now solid and people feel comfortable about it. There's been a lot of discussion on that, as you might guess. Well, and we really don't want to mess with it. We think that that is agreed upon by all sides.
Okay. That was what I wanted to know.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what's the enforcement mechanism if an insurer decides to just disregard this?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I would assume that DCBS and the usual policy restrictions would apply. I mean, if you've got a policy, you've offered a benefit, and you don't pay it, you're going to go to court and get that changed. I imagine you go through DCBS first.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right, so we don't need Lori, really?
She was here to back me up so I didn't screw up.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Did I make any mistakes? Okay.
I'd like Judy Ursetti, Toby Rates, and Paul. Paul's going to be on the phone, and Melanie Shaw.
Including you are joining your conference as the host. For a menu of available commands, press star pound.
Paul, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Oh, good. Who is going to go first? Okay.
I am, Madam Chair. Is that all right?
Yes, okay. Please.
I was going to hit the screen, but I think I'll just proceed. I do have a handout. I'm not sure if they've received it yet.
That's all right. Just introduce yourself and proceed. It's coming.
I understand it, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Judith Ursetti, and I am Director of State Government Affairs for Autism Speaks, and I'm honored to be back here with you today. I was here in 2011 speaking on the same issue. And I am going to proceed rather quickly because you have providers, stakeholders, parents that have much to share. What I'd like to share with you is, as Director of State Government Affairs for Autism Speaks, I work nationally on this issue in the passage, implementation, and enforcement of autism insurance legislation across the country. So I'd like to share a little bit of information with you to contemplate as you're considering moving forward with this legislation. In my presentation, I have information about what autism is and what the applicable treatments are. I'm not going to go down that road. Senator Bates already did a wonderful job of doing that. I will say that the American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend screening 18 months and 24-month-old children for autism spectrum disorder. And so you all well know that the numbers are rising. Children are being screened. What occurs after they're screened is potentially a diagnosis, and then pediatricians all across the nation are prescribing evidence-based treatments like speech, OT, PT, and this therapy we're talking a great deal about called applied behavior analysis. There's a wealth of evidence behind applied behavior analysis. In my presentation, I have nuggets from many different very reputable sources, the Surgeon General, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, NIMH, CDC, the list goes on. OPM recently made a decision. They have 8 million members across the country in their federal employee health benefit plans, and they made a recommendation this last year that applied behavior analysis could be included as a benefit in their plans, and they've been rolling that out, and it's making a huge difference to federal employees across the nation. And then finally, there is a recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics, as ABA is the gold standard of care for autism treatment. What occurs with families when they can't access this treatment? And that is what is happening in states where laws do not require it. Parents are told that it's critical that their children access early intervention. Brains are malleable in the early years of life. Intensive early intervention is key, but most parents can't access it because their health plans specifically exclude this coverage. And again, that's why we're here. So it's a tremendous cost to the individual who has an autism spectrum disorder, as they may never learn to speak, communicate, point, interact socially. The paralysis of an autism spectrum disorder that prevents them from connecting with the world around them remains, and that is just unacceptable when there are evidence-based treatments that can make such a difference. The cost is not only to the individual and their family, but also to society. There's an often cited study from the Harvard School of Public Health that estimates the cost, the incremental cost of autism over a person's life is $3.2 million, and that is not a small sum, and it's definitely something to consider as you're weighing this issue. And with 1 in 88 children now being diagnosed, according to the CDC, back in 1975, it was 1 in 5,000, and now, of course, it's 1 in 88 children. It's certainly something that has to be addressed. And this is not disturbing me at all because I have a little boy about that age who sounds just about like that. So it's funny that it doesn't even register. Anyway, come on up and sit on my lap. The national response has been a common sense response from states as diverse as Texas, Massachusetts, Illinois, the Midwest, the South, red and blue, have all been moving forward to pass meaningful autism insurance legislation. There's a map in your handout of green states. All of those states require that health insurers that are state regulated cover applied behavior analysis treatment for autism spectrum disorder. So it's robust treatment that is included in these green maps. My home state of Texas was the third state, the progressive home state of Texas that I'm from, was the third state to do such a thing. And that was not long after my son was diagnosed, and I realized that this battle needed to be fought. And so I'm honored to have worked in many of these states, and I'm honored to be here today with you, hoping to work towards that solution for Oregon families as well. Very quickly, And the final thing I want to touch on, I have more information in my packet, but I want to give others time, is how much does this cost? Senator Bates, you referenced that, and that's something that legislators and regulators struggle with all across the country. The wonderful thing that we have now is actual cost data. It's not a projection. It's not an estimate. It's actual cost data, and it's not from Autism Speaks, and it's not from an autism advocacy organization or even the health plans, but it's from the Missouri Department of Insurance is my current favorite source, and that's included on page 8 of your handout. When they passed their autism insurance legislation, they took a step saying, every year we want our DOI to let us know how many people are being affected by this and what is it costing. So they provide a report every year. I'm happy to give you the entire reports if they're helpful if you move forward with a work session. But in year one, the premium impact per member per month was 25 cents. And in year two, it grew to 38 cents per member per month. So as you mentioned, Senator Bates, you hear projections everywhere from $1 to $20. The real numbers are far less. And if I could, I'd like to sort of explain why very quickly. When you think about that number, 1 in 88 children, and you think, as many people who are making estimates think, every one of these children is going to need $50,000 worth of care a year, just throwing out a number. They're going to need an intensive program. That's not an accurate picture. And if you'll permit me, I have two children on the autism spectrum, one with very severe autism and one with Asperger's syndrome. My son with autism, with classic autism, has needed intensive services. He would be what you would call a $50,000 child at one point in the early years. My daughter, however, with Asperger's syndrome, has actually never had an hour of applied behavior analysis therapy in her life. She hasn't needed it. She's needed some psychological services, some social skills. But when you're doing the calculation, she's included in many of the projections. So if these numbers look low to you, I would ask you to please consider that. The autism spectrum is diverse, and the amount of resources and the types of resources needed for the individuals behind the diagnosis makes a real difference. And very quickly, I will point out, too, that I love it that we also got information from some state employee health plans that you can look at and compare with what you think the potential will be for yours. And again, this is year two data. We didn't want to pull year one data because it takes a while to ramp up, get the providers in place, let families know that this is available, work through the system. So the year two data indicates an average, again, of 31 cents per member per month. So that seems to be the trend that it's hitting right around that point. And that is certainly far less than what is being projected, and I hope would cause the fiscal note to be less than has been projected in the past. And with that, I have a lot more information to provide, but I think that I will give my time to others. Madam Chair, if you have any questions.
Let's hear the panel first.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senators, good afternoon. My name is Toby Rates, and I live in outer southeast Portland. I'm here in my capacity as the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon, as well as the mother of two children on the autism spectrum. And similar to Judith, I'll add, I have a very similar situation. I have one child who has Asperger's, who has not and has never used ABA therapy, and I have another child who's very severely impacted. The Autism Society of Oregon is the state's largest autism group and the only one that operates statewide. We represent everyone affected by autism, including individuals on the autism spectrum, their families, and their care providers. Our mission is to empower these individuals to improve the quality of their lives through education, support, and information. Over 5,800 people access ASO as a resource and participate in ASO activities in all regions of the state. I am here in support of Senate Bill 365. This legislation would clarify existing law to require that people on the autism spectrum have insurance coverage for autism therapies. These medically necessary, evidence-based therapies help autistic individuals live more functional and productive lives and to reduce their dependence on government supports. Providing intensive therapies, particularly for young children who need it, reduces costs to the educational system by reducing the need for special ed services, and in the long run, reduces the need for government supports for adults. providing the right therapies to the right children at the right time can be the difference between an adult who is earning a paycheck and one who's drawing government support. We are grateful for the leadership of Senator Bates in bringing together all of the stakeholders to work to try and reach consensus on this very important issue. I'm a member of the legislative work group that he mentioned, and we have met several times in the past year for what I would say are frank and productive discussions. We've made enormous progress, and I don't think we would have done that without Senator Bates' leadership. But there are a few important points that we still have to resolve. In my opinion, the issues aren't insurmountable, and they can be worked out with further conversations. As particularly as long as we keep in mind Senator Bates's admonition to keep the children first. That's what we're here to do, to help these children who desperately need our help. We're really pleased that one private insurer, Kaiser Permanente, has been voluntarily covering autism therapies since last November, without age limits, without dollar limits, and without visit limits. They recently asked for an increase in the premium for this coverage at $1 per member per month. And this was based on an estimate of their costs, from what I understand. We are pretty confident that once they have the data in hand from implementing this, that their costs will be more accurate and will reflect the costs that we're seeing in Missouri and in other places that Judith mentioned, of 38 cents per member per month. We applaud Kaiser for doing this, and we would love to see other health insurers in Oregon following suit. I'm speaking for myself and for all the parents here, as well as those who couldn't be present, when I try to relate to you the anguish of being told that your child has a lifelong disability, and usually is a very young child, age 3 or younger, and that your child requires medical intervention. That effective medical interventions exist, but they're extremely expensive, and insurance isn't going to cover it. So in most cases, the result of a very expensive medical diagnosis, which is oftentimes not covered by insurance, is the equivalent of, yes, your child's autistic. Good luck with that. That's just simply not enough for our parents and our children. The autism community has waited years for our children's needs to be addressed by the medical community. Last year when I testified, 29 other states had insurance coverage for autism treatments. The number is now up to 32, I believe, if not higher. And we believe it is past time that Oregon has joined the fight to give autistic individuals the chance to achieve their potential of leading productive, meaningful lives. So we're asking you to take action on SB 365. And hopefully we can continue to work on it and reach a point of consensus.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time to hear our concerns and testimonies on SB 365. My name is Melanie Shaw. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst and a former board member and member of the Oregon Association for Behavior Analysis. I'm also the owner and director of Play Connections Autism Services in Beaverton, Oregon. I want to first explain that I have that difficult conversation with parents on a weekly basis, that yes, we have your child in our intake process. We can absolutely serve your child to the best of our ability, but we just found out your insurance does not cover ABA services as previously thought, and we're going to have to place you again on the wait list until something else comes through for you. This is something that I have to do on every week, and it's very troublesome. So I'm a great advocate of SB 365, and I would just strongly support that as a representative of board-certified behavior analysts, providers of ABA services within the state of Oregon. I did have some slides talking about what applied behavior analysis is, and the training that is required of ABA providers. I did want to specify that we are a very distinct profession, as is occupational therapy, speech-language pathology, psychology, and it requires specialized training. We are certified by the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, which is an internationally accepted standard of credentialing in behavior analysis. We are a nationally accredited organization which certifies board-certified behavior analysts, BCBA and BCBAD, which is the PH level level, as well as board-certified assistant behavior analyst, which is the bachelor's level certification for behavior analysis. I did want to review the ABA treatment model, which is the gold standard of treating children with autism. The way that we can provide a very high quality level of care, but also keep it very cost effective, is that direct services are typically not provided full time by the board certified behavior analyst. This would be incredibly expensive. We have a very cost effective model, which allows interventionists, which are very well trained, to provide the many, many multiple trials and intervention that's required to make significant progress with children across the spectrum. The requirements for the BCBA is that you have to have a master's degree, 225 classroom hours of coursework in behavior analysis, 1,500 hours of supervised experience. We pass an examination, and we have ongoing continuing education requirements. And we follow guidelines for responsible conduct and professional disciplinary and ethical standards. So what we're asking is that a board be provided within Oregon for us to receive regulation as a distinct profession from others. So in summary, ORABA strongly supports insurance coverage for ABA treatment for ASD. ORABA strongly supports licensing and registration for qualified ABA providers. And we strongly recommend that we move forward with this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Comments? Thank you so much. Paul?
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Paul Turtle. I'm a resident of Northwest Portland. Do you have my PowerPoint presentation available?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm.
I'll start with slide 2 entitled Volunteer Advocacy. As many of you will recall, this is now my third consecutive legislative session to talk about this bill, and with the help of Senator Bates and the cooperation of all the members of the legislative work group, I do hope that this will be the last and we will get it done. After the 2011 legislative session, when we were unable to pass Senate Bill 555, I went back to my own insurer, Kaiser, and this was, you know what, I think I want you to, you know, my kids have autism, your doctors have prescribed ABA therapy, I'd like you to cover it now. And after a lengthy process of about 6 months, Kaiser was unable to articulate any legal basis to not pay for ABA for my kids. The best thing they could come up with was that their own physicians were incorrect, and that my kids simply did not really need ABA therapy. That was when we went to the external review process. So Senator Bates mentioned the IROs, and we were ultimately able to get IROs to overturn both of those denials, and Kaiser has been reimbursing my son's ABA therapy retroactive to September 2011, shortly after that session ended. Since that time, I have gone on to help many other families through the similar process. Counting work by myself and others, I have counted about 19 different external review appeals on applied behavior analysis. Of those, 16 overturned insurer denials that ABA was either experimental or somehow not medically necessary. One was properly dismissed by the IRO on grounds it was a contractual dispute, and they were correct. Only two actually upheld an insurer denials, and in both of those cases, investigations by the Department of Consumer and Business Services concluded that the IROs had failed to comply with administrative rules and statutes regarding conduct of external reviews, and I will be working with Commissioner Savage on new administrative rules to improve quality assurance for the IRO process. If you could move down to the next slide, 3, typical IRO comments. These are examples of the kinds of things that the IROs, which were contracted by the state of Oregon to review these cases, these are the kinds of things that those IROs had to say about applied behavior analysis. They have been, you know, consistent, you know, in declaring that ABA therapy is medically necessary for treatment of autism spectrum disorders and that denying ABA therapy is not consistent with national standards of care. If you could move down to the next slide, 4, insurance coverage of ABA therapy. What I will do next is just briefly review what we know as consumers about what different insurance companies in Oregon are doing with respect to ABA. Beginning with Kaiser, I'm extremely pleased to say that after losing more than a dozen of these IRO decisions, Kaiser made a very, very wise, proper, and ethical decision. And as of October 1st, 2012, they have begun covering ABA therapy pretty much on the same terms we have outlined in Senate Bill 365 under their coverage of outpatient mental health care. This did not involve any changes to the contract or benefit structure. They simply declared that it was a covered service. There are no contractual age dollar visit limits on group plans, as there couldn't be because of mental health parity, but they do make a very reasonable utilization control. They promptly approve younger patients for an initial 20 visits until a treatment plan can be developed. For older patients, they do an internal evaluation within their mental health department to make sure that ABA is really the appropriate therapy. We have seen older patients successfully approved after that process, and we appreciate that. The other is Kaiser is, you know, has been contracting with the exact same types of providers called for in Senate Bill 365, which is to say board-certified behavior analysts such as Melanie Shaw and paraprofessionals under their supervision. A couple of months ago, Kaiser submitted a rate filing to the Oregon Insurance Division in which it gave its official cost estimate for the service, and it estimated $1 per member per month in its official rate filing that it would be applying effective, third or fourth quarter of this year. So that's Kaiser's official estimate. You heard from Judith, the Missouri Department of Insurance had actual data at 38 cents. Kaiser's coming up with a dollar. We think between 38 cents and a dollar is pretty reasonable. Move to the next slide, five on Pacific Source and Providence. Pacific Source has been covering ABA therapy on group plans at the, in their words, at the direction of the court since the McHenry versus Pacific Source ruling by the U.S. District Court in 2010. There had been some issues in terms of what kinds of providers they were paying. They had been limiting that only to licensed providers, of which there were virtually none in Oregon. I'm very pleased to say that as of December 1st, 2012, Pacific Source has been contracting with unlicensed BCBAs to provide that therapy, as covered in Senate Bill 365, but they are not currently reimbursing paraprofessionals. We're having much more problems with Providence. Providence has lost two external review appeals regarding ABA therapy. And whereas Kaiser took that as a lesson to say, you know what, we need to look at our policy, Providence went the other direction and has declared that, as I have quoted here from one of its denial letters, Providence now asserts that it has a contractual exclusion for treatment for all developmental disabilities. This appears to us to be a violation of ORS 7438.190, which clearly mandates coverage of developmental disabilities, including autism. And with respect to autism, a violation of ORS 7438.168, Oregon's mental health parity statute, which requires coverage for mental and nervous conditions, including autism. You can move to the next slide, six on UnitedHealthcare. UnitedHealthcare does cover autism in its plan. However, it has a contractual clause that explicitly excludes coverage of, quote, intensive behavioral therapies such as applied behavioral analysis for autism spectrum disorder. That exclusion applies regardless of medical necessity. We have been in discussions with the Oregon Insurance Division, which has been reviewing the matter with the Department of Justice since approximately June regarding compliance with mental health parity and other statutes. Recently, the Insurance Division contacted an impacted consumer and encouraged them to consult with a private legal counsel on this while they continued their investigation. We move down to the next slide on Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. Regents is telling us that it excludes ABA therapy on grounds that it is, quote, investigational, unquote. That's a little bit disappointing for us. 2 years ago in the legislative work group on Senate Bill 555, Dr. Chava Mera, the executive medical director for Regents, very clearly informed the work group that, quote, there is sufficient evidence that children between ages 3 and 11 are helped by ABA. We're not arguing about that. It works in younger children. It really does make a difference in their lives. Earlier this week, just a few days ago, U.S. District Court in Michigan declared that Blue Cross Blue Shield's characterization and exclusion of ABA therapy as experimental investigative was and is arbitrary and capricious, and we're confident that same would apply to Regents in Oregon as well. We note that Regents' most recent update to its medical policy manual from March 1st clearly states that, quote, ABA providers may be but are not required to be licensed healthcare professionals, and specifically lists board-certified behavior analysts and ABA therapists or paraprofessionals as providers for ABA therapy. We assume on that basis that Regents would not deny coverage to an unlicensed provider meeting the medical policy manual criteria, but we have not yet tested that. If you can move down to the next slide on the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Plan officially denies coverage of ABA. This is from Guideline Note 75, referencing a 2008 HR Health Resources Commission report. It declares that there is limited evidence for the effectiveness of applied behavior analysis therapy and limits all behavioral health treatment to 8 hours per month. There have also been court rulings and settlement agreements on that regarding Medicaid. A year ago in Florida, U.S. District Court found that a similar conclusion of Florida was arbitrary, was unreasonable in its process, arbitrary and capricious, unreasonable in its conclusion, and ordered that state to immediately begin providing ABA therapy to all Medicaid-eligible persons under the age of 21. Recently, Medicaid in Washington State signed a settlement agreement and began covering ABA effective January 1st. Move down to the next slide, 9. So, from my perspective, having worked on this legislation for a number of years and working with many different consumers on this, the real reason to pass this bill is not to provide consumers with a new right that we don't already have. I think it is very clear that the law already mandates coverage for autism. This is not experimental. We have some very responsible insurers in the state that are covering ABA therapy. We have others that are not. And what this really does is it basically ends the chaos. It establishes a clear, consistent, best practice policy for coverage of treatment of autism in Oregon. It also provides licensure and state regulation for the ABA providers such as Melanie Shaw and the paraprofessionals who work for her. We believe that licensure is an extremely important thing that needs to be done no matter what decisions are made regarding the insurance mandate. We would be very happy to have a new insurance mandate that clearly spells out the requirements for this, provided that it does not undermine the rights that we already have under Oregon's mental health parity law. So thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Well, thank you, Paul, so much. Any questions? Appreciate all of this information. With that, I'd like to call up Eric and Christy Rule, Tara McMillan, and Nora Brock. Please proceed.
Okay. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tara McMillan. I drove here from Bend today to be with you, and I'm driving back tonight. I am a mother of a 6-year-old son who has autism, and I'm here because I want to share an ABA therapy success story with you. My son was diagnosed with autism at age 2.5. He received approximately 25 hours a week of ABA therapy from age 2.5 to 5.5. The changes in him have been nothing short of miraculous. He is now attending kindergarten at a public school. He is independent in the classroom, is in the highest reading group, and has many friends. If you've all received the handout, if you could turn to page 2, I've included some of his test results. On page 2, it shows his test results from going to an intensive early childhood partial hospitalization program at UCLA, where he received 30 hours a week of ABA therapy. The first column are his intake scores. If you see, his chronological age was 32 months at intake. If you look, he was behind in all areas of development. After 9 weeks of ABA therapy, you can see his exit scores. His chronological age was 34 months, and as you can see, he progressed a year or more in all areas of development. If you turn to the third page, we had Michael, our son, evaluated three separate times over the course of his childhood, all at the same place at OHSU Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. These were evaluations to determine if he still qualified for an autism diagnosis. If you look in 2009, his original diagnosis was autistic disorder, global developmental delay. That means he was behind in all areas of development. I won't go through the nitty-gritty of all the scores, but if you look at his last evaluation in 2012, his diagnosis was high-functioning autistic disorder resolving. That means that his symptoms are going away. In fact, if I told someone he had autism right now, they would look at me like I was crazy. They do. I don't tell anyone that anymore because they think I'm crazy that I even put my son in therapy. Michael's progress has been amazing, but it came at a huge price to our family. Our insurance did not cover the cost of ABA, so we paid for it ourselves. I would estimate that our family paid approximately $100,000 over the course of Michael's childhood for ABA therapy. In conclusion, I'd just like to say I am not here for my family. We are done. My son is doing well. He will be an independent, productive member of our society. I'm here today for other families who are not able to pay the cost of ABA therapy. Please support SB 365 and help autistic children in Oregon reach their full potential.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Eric Real. I'm from Salem, Oregon. This is my wife, Christy. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share our family's experience with the powerful results of applied behavior analysis. Our daughter, Ellie, or Eleanor, is now 15 years old. She has autism, and unfortunately, like many individuals with autism, she suffers from self-injurious behavior. When she was 11 years old, we had to make the wrenching decision to place her in a group home. Her self-injury was so severe that she needed two people next to her at all times. We hoped that her group home agency and DHS would have the resources and expertise to help her. 3 years later, Ellie was spending her time wrapped up in a blanket from her neck to below her knees during all waking hours. She was still hitting herself 600 times a day. It was obvious to us that we needed to seek outside help. Dr. Cynthia Anderson, a board-certified behavior analyst and licensed psychologist at University of Oregon, told us about an inpatient program at Johns Hopkins in Maryland. The specialized program where Dr. Anderson had worked as a therapist uses advanced ABA techniques to determine the function of problem behaviors and develop treatment targeted to those functions. Johns Hopkins achieved unimagined success for Ellie. After a 5-month admission, her self-injury has decreased by over 90%. She has her life back. She enjoys long walks to the park, riding her bicycle, swinging, and playing with water. All things she couldn't do before because she didn't want to move or even see her hands. The bad news is that we don't have access to such comprehensive ABA services here in Oregon because insurers are, by and large, refusing to pay for it. The only reason our insurance company eventually agreed to pay for the treatment was due to the medical consequences of Ellie's severe self-injury. Instead of attracting top professionals to Oregon, we are losing them, including Dr. Cynthia Anderson, who had a vision for providing a clinic like Johns Hopkins here in Oregon, but couldn't make it go because of lack of insurance coverage for ABA. Please help attract board-certified behavior analysts to Oregon by requiring insurers to pay for ABA. Oregonians shouldn't have to have a medical crisis and fly across the country to get help for their loved ones with autism. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Nora Brock, is she here? All right, Tom Holt, Elise Brown, and Christy Kernick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And we thank you for allowing us to be here to offer some comments on Senate Bill 365. And I'm glad that you're still here, Senator Bates, as you've gotten this whole chain rolling down the tracks. And as Mr. Turdall said, we've had this conversation for the last three legislative sessions. And recalling at the close of 2012, Dr. Bates, when you pulled everybody together, you and Senator Haas, the advocates and health plan representatives and representatives from the education community, got everybody around the table and said, we've got to do something about this. And we knew that at that time, Senator Bates was going to be putting together a work group in the incoming year, and health plans were ready for that. And as said, the work group started in May of 2012, and the health plans participated alongside with the advocates and meeting multiple times throughout the remainder of 2012. And again, our thanks to you, Senator Bates, for taking the leadership in doing this. I think work groups are always helpful. It allows both sides to understand each other's issues, and I think only good comes from that. I'm joined here by AHIP members who participated in the work group and want to mention one in particular, Dr. David Pass with Providence Health Plan, an interesting credential actually that lent itself nicely to the work that we did as a group. He's also the former director of the Oregon Health Resource Commission, a volunteer commission appointed by the governor. And that commission provides a public forum for discussing and development of consensus on significant emerging health issues. And when Dr. Pass was leading the way, they were charged with surveying evidence on autism treatments. And I think that expertise really lent itself nicely to our efforts, really helped guide our efforts. So I'm joined here today with Christy Kernett, who was an active member of the work group along with Tom Holt, and I'm going to pass it along to them and let them get into the details.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Kernett. I work for Pacific Source Health Plans. Thank you for your time today. In the interest of that time, I'm going to be brief and point out a couple of things that are near and dear to us. I think we can all agree that over the past few years, there's been a significant level of disagreement about what is and what should be covered for ABA therapy. That's led to a lot of frustration and angst, as you've heard, both from everybody, probably from Ural's time and certainly from the insurers, and most significantly for the families. Given that, we think it is incredibly important that the wording of this bill be very deliberate and thoughtful so that we can provide clarity of what should be covered in the future for ABA therapy. That clarity will then allow for some predictability for both families and insurers and hopefully solve these issues that we've all been seeing. So again, I'll keep it brief in the interest of time, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Chair Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I just want to say at the outset, we have learned a lot from the conversations with the advocates, the parents involved with this, with autism, which is just an incredibly frustrating condition for everyone involved because we don't know what causes it and there is no cure. We engaged in this because we see, even though we regard this applied behavioral analysis to be investigational, because the evidence doesn't quite rise to the kind of gold standard that we use for most things, which is what the experience of the Health Resources Commission was a few years ago as well, we see great promise. It does work for some kids, particularly for younger kids. We've consulted in particular with the University of Utah, which is a center of excellence in autism research in the western U.S. It happens prior to our engagement in this legislation, our foundation arm gave a pretty substantial grant to them to pursue that research. And we took some advice from them about some of the structure that's in the bill, as well as some learnings from other states and their beginnings on this. We're also the administrator for the Washington State Employee Program, which is beginning a program for ABA. And we've learned a lot about from them in that process of how can we actually establish and administer a benefit appropriately so that there's the right providers with the right kind of oversight and the proper accountability and not break the bank. This is, you know, we expect this is going to be a fairly substantial fiscal. You will see estimates across the board. A lot of that is driven by different populations that different carriers may serve. You know, I would expect, for example, that proportion to the population it serves, the OEB program may have a more substantial fiscal than some others because there are simply more kids in that population. But that's, you know, at a high level, the things we tried to follow in developing the bill, and unfortunately through no fault of LC, with some system problems they've had the last few days, we just got the language that we've been working on in the last few hours, and none of us have had the opportunity to go through that. But at a high level, what we've tried to do is come back to follow the evidence, what's going to be helpful, and what can we track. So the idea of having, as Dr. Bates described, a confirmation of diagnosis or diagnosis by people who are specialists in this area was very important. And having an age limitation in the legislation is following the evidence, because to the extent that there is decent evidence, it tends to indicate that this is more successful with some kids who are basically school age and below. It's not as promising in other ages, but we're going to watch this as we go along. There is one element of the bill that I think is important. We did put in a sunset date in the language very purposefully because we think it's very important for this body down the road a few years to take a look at the data. At that time, we'll have good cost data. We'll have good data on success here, and we'll hopefully be able to come back with some tweaks that make it even better at that time. And, you know, but we think that the effort, despite the difficulties of getting to an ultimate yes on this, is it's a very technical piece of legislation to put together with some very passionate people on both sides who are all trying to do the right thing, I think. It's worth whatever investment we end up with on a fiscal to move forward for the families and for us as carriers to be able to consistently administer this program. You know, we do provide coverage for autism services generally today. It's the ABA that has been somewhat controversial in recent years. I think the language that we're all going to be looking through line by line, if it's reflecting the most recent conversations and working drafts that we had, probably still needs a little bit of work over the next few days, but I'm hopeful that we are close. And so I hope that we'll be able to come back before the committee, you know, in the next week or so and have something that we can all feel good about on all sides to send to Ways and Means to then find the money for it. So with that, I'll close. And thank you for everyone's patience today at this hour.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, it is extremely important since we just got the dash threes this afternoon, or at least I did, that advocates and opponents, we're all advocates, all right, really look at it because we'll need feedback from that. Okay?
Thank you.
No comments. Thank you. And then the last two is Nora Brockbeck and Bruce Bishop. Nora, would you please introduce yourself and
proceed? Sure.
Madam Chair, my name is Nora Brock. I'm not really prepared for a statement because I was just found out the last minute I could even come to this. My husband got home and was able to watch my grandson, who has severe autism. I was one of Paul Terdahl's people that he helped gain ABA therapy for through Kaiser. My grandson had an individual policy. We went through all the external reviews, and we did gain ABA therapy. But unfortunately for my grandson, that therapy turned out to be limited. He had 40 visits that were limited for 2 years, for 40 visits. They also claimed there was a unit. They called it a unit when they described the amount of therapy he would receive and could never clarify to me what a unit meant. So we went ahead with the therapy. We had been at Building Bridges, and my son had been paying for that out of pocket for 3 days a week for 2 hours a day. So during the summer months, we decided to use our therapy and use it up and try to get him the most we could get for the bang of, you know, the 40 visits. We went through that, and at the end of the process of the summer, my son ended up paying, I think, more than what Kaiser paid. His cost at the end of the summer, I think, was like $1,500, and that was 3 days a week for 4 hours. My grandson is very severe. We attained another health insurance policy through Providence, because we needed to get him to some other doctors outside of Kaiser. Children with autism, they face so many obstacles with doctors, with treatments, and seeing what has happened to my grandson, he's on the tip of the iceberg. We just went through a process of realizing that he's essentially blind in his left eye. It was through my daughter, who's a dentist, that we were able to determine this. His ophthalmologist at Kaiser did not realize this, even though prior to this she had been given a notice from the first ophthalmologist that took a look at him, thinking that he had a pale nerve. But it took my daughter taking this to task and getting him outside of Kaiser to look at and see what was really going on with his eye, and determine that he has a pale optic nerve, and in addition to that, he has a retinal inflammation with his left eye. Among the other things, we've just determined that he has mitochondrial disease. That was, through our own efforts again, was denied by his health insurance. To go looking for that, we went and looked ourselves. Beyond that, we've just determined that he probably has another disease that is possibly a genetic inherited disease, but Kaiser, again, did not look for that disease. There was a potential that they thought he had it, but they did not look. We are in the process right now of determining he has that disease also. These are all out-of-pocket expenses that we are entailing, and essentially we can't afford ABA. I mean, we just paid for the surgery at OHSU in December. We paid our deductible, which was a total of, by the time we paid deductible and the additional funds, it was $4,000, and we just did another one in January, so additional another $4,000 just out of pocket, $8,000 in four months. And these are all things that have been overlooked, that has taken us as a family to get to the bottom of. ABA is essential. My grandson, under ABA, with the help of ABA, he was able to sit in the classroom. He was able to learn. Since we can't afford it anymore, he is now in Sherwood School District, which is a great school district. I have no complaints against them, but they are not ABA. They do not do ABA, and he has lost. He has steadily gone backwards this whole entire year. He's a full-time student there, and they do their best, but they do not do ABA. And ABA had made a difference in my grandson's life. And I feel that it's something that, as a family, as a grandparent dealing with a severely autistic child, it's something that is that should be mandatory, that that you as a government officials should be looking at these families and saying, yes, they need this, we need to do this. Every 33 states, or 30, two states have now done that, have approved ABA for the states, and we as a state need to join them. We are not a regressive state. We're a progressive state. And I hope you and all the rest of the people on this board understand that Oregon needs to step up and take this and do the right thing by these children, because we've suffered enough.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Bruce.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bates, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, senior counsel with Northwest Permanente, which is an 1,100-member physician group, multi-specialty physician group, that's responsible for providing medical care to the enrollees of Kaiser Permanente. You will have my written testimony, and I'm going to summarize it for you. You've already heard about current practices within Kaiser Permanente of making services, including ABA services, available to members where that treatment can be effective. Senate Bill 365 proposes to mandate coverage for the Oregon Health Plan, for small employer health benefit plans, for PEB, and for OWEB. And we do not support the bill as introduced and have not had a chance to look at the amendments that you may be considering later. But I want to bring two specific issues to the committee's attention before you act on any legislation this session. First, I want to draw your attention to ORS 171-870 to 171-880. These are statutes that require that mandated benefits be accompanied by a report that identify their social and financial impacts, so that as a legislative committee, when you are reviewing proposals like this, you know what the costs and benefits are going to be. To our knowledge, no such report accompanies Senate Bill 365. Second, we believe that enactment of Senate Bill 365 may disqualify Oregon families from receiving federal subsidies for the mandated services under the Act when they get coverage through Cover Oregon. Cover Oregon is the exchange that will take effect in January of 2014. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government will subsidize coverage for middle to lower income families for essential health benefits. But to qualify for such subsidies, the essential health benefits have to have been covered by a state's benchmark plan before January 1st of 2012. What that means, we think, is that with the enactment of Senate Bill 365, you will be declaring a new mandated benefit after the federal deadline. That means the federal government may not pay the subsidies that would otherwise be available, and it means that the state is responsible for paying those subsidies either to the families or to the health insurance companies that provide the services. We think that may be the result of your passing this law, even though I'm sure I could say that's not your intent to forego federal subsidies that would be available to help provide this kind of care. I've included in the testimony an excerpt from the federal rules that were promulgated in February on this point. The printed copy that you have cuts off the last line, and I'll make sure that you have a complete copy of that available for the record. I don't know what level of subsidies Oregon might be foregoing by enacting Senate Bill 365. We can't quantify that for you. That may well be a decision that legislative fiscal can put a number to. But we are concerned that any enactment today of a new mandate will result in the state having to pay for those costs without federal support for those services. So we urge your caution in proceeding with a new mandated benefit that takes effect in 2014 in the way that Senate Bill 365 is currently drafted. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Yeah, this is news to me. I'm sorry that Senator Bates missed this testimony. Senator Bates, since you were part of the work group
I would like you to look at the two issues. There were two issues, if you look on the beginning of the second page, on how this would affect the subsidies to those who will be under
ACA.
Cover Oregon.
I'll go back and research this further, but my memory of it, and may be wrong, was that since this has been already covered by insurers in the state under individual issues, and that the proponents, I believe, think it's covered under mental health already, and this is really not a new mandate. It's just formalizing how we go about doing this, putting sideboards on it. Good people can disagree. I am not an attorney. I don't want to go out too far here. That was my understanding in the work group. We'll go back and research the CDN and see where we're at on it. We obviously can't jeopardize ACO for this. I don't believe this is actually a new mandate. I believe it's actually a continuation, and it's covered under the mental health parity law. But we will research this further and get an opinion.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, to that issue, there may be ways that you can draft legislation that would achieve that result, but my belief is that by enacting a mandate that says it's a new mandate and that takes effect January 1st of 2014, when the federal government looks at that, they will say it's a new mandate. And that's the problem you may want to solve.
Well, I would hope you'll be able to help us do that.
I'm serious. I'm serious. Jackson,
did you want to make a comment?
Ma'am.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shane Jackson. I have the great pleasure of sitting in on the committee and helping my people out. I'm the lobbyist for the Autism Society of Oregon and for Autism Speaks. We looked at that issue about the Affordable Care Act coverage, and it's our belief and from our research that because the United Healthcare policy was used as the base policy for our essential health care benefits package, and that that qualifies as the package before enactment. So we are covered, and we do have a plan that does cover ABA therapy. So under our definition, and we've talked about it with the insurance commissioner, and we've talked about with the AG, and we've talked about with LC, we believe that we are covered under this issue, that we already have ABA certified covered in the essential health care benefits package, and our passage of this is just a clarification of an existing benefit that already is in the package. We have in the room here Lisa McHenry, who adjudicated the test of that, and she won against that. Mm-hmm. Against that, so there's a federal, we believe,
federal,
a federal judge backing us up that that is a essential benefit that is covered and has already been in the package. So we looked at it already. So, right. But I do appreciate on the other
federal. I
want
everyone to look at the dash threes and then. Because I want to move a bill, and we only have until the 18th, and it will be moving down to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. That's all that we have, I think, correct?
Yes.
So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365, and we're adjourned.